Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, WISO Community Voices producer Ashley Appleman considers two of Yellow Springs' greatest assets. Stay tuned for that. And WISO's Dave Barber speaks with a civil rights veteran about Freedom Summer 50 years ago. Later in the program, music from the Village Harmony Choir from their in-studio performance this week. Up first, on Friday, funeral services were held for former Clark County Commissioner and 15-year state legislator Merle Grace Kearns, who died last weekend at the age of 76. As WISO's Wayne Baker reported, the veteran Republican lawmaker had earned the respect from both sides of the political aisle during her career.
Kearns served voters in Clark, Madison, and Greene counties as a legislator and was known to champion causes for those who were less fortunate. Ohio Senate President Keith Faber, a Republican from Salina, released a statement calling Kearns an extraordinary public servant who represented the most vulnerable in our society. Greene County GOP officials also issued a statement saying that Merle Grace's influence in the General Assembly touched lives across Ohio, especially those with mental health or developmental disabilities. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
On Friday, Governor John Kasich ordered flags at all state agencies flown at half-mast in honor of Kearns. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's has upgraded the city of Dayton's credit rating. It's a move that bodes well for the city, which has faced serious economic challenges in the last couple of years. Dayton City Manager Tim Reardon called the upgrade a huge achievement for the city. The upgrade doesn't mean the city is flush with cash, but according to Reardon, the city is managing its resources well. Another credit agency, Moody's, held the city's credit rating stable, along with strong fiscal management. Both S&P and Moody's cited the city of Dayton's stable cash reserve fund as a reason for their positive outlook. The International Gay Games wrapped up in Ohio on Saturday in venues across Northeast Ohio. One issue that hung over all sporting events last week was the concern over HIV/AIDS. Its presence prompted sweeping changes in many sports. While drug cocktails are helping to keep more athletes alive, strict safety precautions were enforced to protect against the spread of the disease. From Ohio Public Radio, member station WCPN, David C. Barnett reports that some of those improvements came with a cost.
We didn't know a lot about HIV in 1990 when Steve Harrington first tested positive. At that point, everyone seemed to be telling him that his life was over, from his doctors to experts on TV.
I remember watching a talk show with the head of the health department for New Hampshire, and somebody asked her, does everybody die from HIV? And she said yes.
24 years later, Harrington's still here, a fact he attributes to medication and a love of basketball, which keeps him physically fit and mentally focused. He's in Cleveland this week, competing in the Gay Games with his team, the Rimbos. Steve Harrington is one of only a handful of athletes who have played in the games ever since they were created in 1982. In those early days, he heard many misguided notions about the virus that lives in his bloodstream and threatens the immune system.
You know, it used to be you didn't want to handle doorknobs. You know, when I first tested positive, they said don't eat raw vegetables, get rid of all your pets. My feeling was, those are part of the reasons I live.
One long-standing misconception about HIV/AIDS was that it was exclusively a gay disease. We now know that there are other ways to contract the virus, including the sharing of needles and unprotected heterosexual sex. Take the case of Los Angeles Lakers point guard Irvin Magic Johnson, who shook the world of sports with a stunning announcement in 1991.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today.
Johnson denied being gay and said that the HIV came from numerous dalliances with women on the road. His retirement proved to be short-lived. Magic Johnson would go on to play in the 1992 NBA All-Star Game. He joined the U.S. men's Olympic basketball dream team that same year and returned to the Lakers for a short stint in 1996. Cleveland Clinic sports health expert Dr. Susan Joy says Johnson's announcement and return to basketball led to major changes throughout professional sports.
You saw the officials calling timeouts and making sure blood was cleaned up, and it's interesting if you watch that now. They're doing the same thing in terms of how they handle blood. You see the athletic trainers wearing very thick gloves, and someone's cleaning the floor, and they use disinfecting solutions appropriately. And We try to just do that across the board.
Due to medical confidentiality rules, athletes are not required to reveal their HIV status, so Susan Joy says universal precautions are taken for everyone in all contact sports, from the pros all the way down to the high school level.
I just think that's good, safe practice for everything we face nowadays and some of the superbugs that are growing out there. You know, I just think you have to exercise caution when there are body fluids involved in a sporting event, and I think that, thankfully, sports has evolved to where the appropriate people exercise oversight of the younger athletes who may otherwise be pretty cavalier about it.
Although there is still no cure for HIV/AIDS, advances in medication have helped stabilize the lives of millions of people, including Olympic diver Greg Louganis, who revealed he was HIV positive in 1995. Speaking to an audience at the City Club of Cleveland this past weekend, Louganis said he's found some peace through a heavy rotation of medication.
I mean, I wouldn't wish my drug regimen on anyone. I take my meds in the morning, I take my meds in the evening, you know, I still take a lot of pills. I don't really categorize it as manageable. It is what it is.
Steve Harrington worries that some younger people have been lulled by the effectiveness of drug cocktails at keeping HIV at bay.
It amazes me right now to hear kids having that feeling that it's manageable, it's not a big deal. When I hear about a younger person becoming infected, I just think it's absolutely preventable and ridiculous that they aren't taking precautions. This is no fun.
The Rimbos have been struggling on the hardwood, losing their first four games so far. But after 24 years fighting this disease, it feels good just to be in the game.
Exhausting. We played a division up from us, and we knew that it was going to be a struggle, but we showed ourselves just fine.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Public Radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. The 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer has brought a number of new and reissued books relating to that crucial event in the civil rights movement. Community Voices producer Dave Barber spoke with a civil rights veteran about his new book.
According to Charlie Cobb, the story of what became known as Freedom Summer could use an introduction and more detail. His new book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, is subtitled How Guns Made the Nonviolent Civil Rights Movement Possible. But it's more than a book about the role of firearms. It's an informative prequel to the summer of 1964. I had a chance to speak with Cobb, who was in Mississippi as a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. I began by asking him to describe who paved the way for the civil rights activism of the 1960s.
In the aftermath of World War II, what you really see is a change in the climate made by black veterans, for the most part, who had been overseas fighting against Nazism, fighting against Japanese and Italian fascism. And these soldiers came back changed because of all of this and far less willing to accept white supremacy. And that change in attitude leads directly, I think, to the civil rights movement as we've come to know it in the 1950s and 1960s.
You illuminate the role of the NAACP and the RCNL in the years prior to 1964. Why were those organizations important?
Young people were, from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality, were a driving force in the 1964 summer project, Freedom Summer. I mean, we were really standing on the shoulders of an older generation, many of whom come out of, as I said, World War II. So what you see is, for instance, the NAACP, really by mid-20th century, is, beginning to emphasize the rights of citizenship. A lot of the early NAACP activity was anti-lynching, for example. Now, by the 1950s, I mean, it's clear to the NAACP is challenging school segregation, you know, saying that we are, black people, are citizens, and we don't have to prove anything when it comes to the rights of citizenship. And one manifestation of this changed attitude is the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, RCNL. A, the Regional Council of Negro Leadership was largely, had many, many black veterans in it. And two, it was waging in Mississippi, particularly in the Mississippi Delta, a fight to gain the full rights of citizenship. And many of the leaders of the RCNL, Aaron Henry, a World War II veteran and later to become state president of the NAACP, Amzie Moore, a local NAACP leader and also a World War II veteran, Megger Evers, who would become the NAACP's state field secretary in Mississippi, the first state field secretary in Mississippi, they formed the leadership of the RCNL, and they also were the grown-ups who encouraged our presence at SNCC and CORE in Mississippi. So you can see a kind of relationship between these guys, and they were mostly men, as veterans, as NAACP leaders and activists, and as people who were welcoming to the young people of SNCC and CORE.
You talk about the powerful gun culture in the South, weak gun control laws that enabled blacks to arm with relative ease. Did the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission and the White Citizens Council, these organizations that stepped up after Brown versus Board of Education, did they put anything in gear to prevent blacks from owning guns?
No. They tried. One legislator tried to introduce gun control legislation, but the gun culture was too powerful. I mean, guns are just too routine in the South. They can never, there's no real interest in trying to disarm black. That attempt had been made after the Civil War in the Reconstruction era where state law attempted to disarm blacks. But in the 1950s and 60s, I'd have to say, no, guns were relatively easy to acquire, although it would have been more difficult for blacks, A, to acquire automatic weapons, and B, to gain a license to carry a concealed weapon. And you could see some differences there. But when it comes to shotguns, pistols, blacks and whites were treated pretty much the same. I doubt that groups like the Sovereignty Commission, which was a spy agency, or the White Citizens Council, which was kind of, as one historian said, a group that bore the face of the Rotary Club, even if it encouraged Klan-like violence. These people weren't riding around at night and facing direct danger from black gunfire the way Ku Klux Klan members would be.
Who were the Deacons for Defense and Justice, and how effective were they?
Well, I think the Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana first arose in Jonesboro, Louisiana, which is North Louisiana, or as they say in Louisiana, the top of the boot, one of the more Klan-ridden parts of Louisiana, very rural. And they essentially emerged to protect nonviolent CORE workers who were organizing around voter registration and, in fact, unlike in Mississippi, engaged in some direct action protests against segregation and public accommodation. And these were a group of men, older men, and largely Korean War or World War II veterans, again, who decided they would not allow CORE workers to be harmed by Ku Klux Klan violence. So they were armed and they were organized. And their very existence really kept violence directed at CORE workers to a minimum. You won't find in looking at the Deacons for Defense and Justice the kind of aggressive attacks on their part. They were purely an organization engaged in self-defense. And as was true in other parts of the South when it came to armed groups, that was pretty much enough to keep marauders away, because as much as these people in the Ku Klux Klan or in other groups proclaimed their commitment to white supremacy, none of them were prepared to die for it.
History tends to get romanticized. You describe the SNCC and CORE shock troops being a romantic image.
That became a part of the narrative, the public narrative.
Right.
You know, and I'm critical of this public narrative, you know, which sure reduces the Southern freedom movement to the most simplistic of components. And one of these simplistic components was a rugged, ragged SNCC and core field workers taking on mad dog sheriffs and crazed Ku Klux Klan members. I mean, that was a romance that has been built into the narrative, which is really not completely true. I mean, SNCC and CORE people were human beings and responded to their situations as best they could and as best that any human being would respond.
You make a strong case for the risk that Mississippians took being lost in this story. And you also describe how important ground-level community organizing was and how that piece of the story also gets missed in this larger romantic image.
What has happened is that the Southern freedom movement has been reduced to the idea of mass protests in public spaces being led by charismatic leaders. And in my view, the real story of the Southern freedom movement is grassroots community organizing, often invisible in rural, out-of-the-way places, in the backwoods. And Julian Bond quipped when we were talking about this as I was really just beginning the book, and he said, yeah, the public narrative of the civil rights movement has been reduced to one sentence. Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and then the white folks saw the light and saved the day. This is an oversimplistic view, and really people in the United States is not very good with history to start with. It doesn't matter whether it's civil rights history or history of the American Revolution. And so we have a incomplete portrait of what the Southern freedom movement was. And I try and correct some of that in this book.
That was Charlie Cobb, a journalist, professor, and former field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. His book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, was published in June. For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Dave Barber.
Learn more about our Community Voices project at WYSO.org. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Now we hear from another Community Voices producer, Ashley Appleman. Every community has assets that are sometimes overlooked or underappreciated. Appleman considers two of Yellow Springs' greatest assets, its senior center and its senior citizens. Here's her report.
Last May, almost 40 Yellow Springs Senior Center members practiced a flash mob dance to celebrate National Senior Health and Fitness Day. Their engagement with the center is high. It provides programs and services that help keep this community vital.
I think it helps me through the day that I stay involved. I cannot see that I would sit at home all day long. I just feel the need to go out and not be by myself.
Andre Bognar is 84. For 10 years, she has been active at the Senior Center.
I go about every day. I participate in many of the activities, and I also volunteer. I participate in Qigong, the meals that they have, chair volleyball that we do, and I volunteer like for doing the mailing of the newsletter, sometimes working at the front desk.
Mary Morgan also relies on activities at the Senior Center. She is 88 years old and has a strict fitness regimen to both recover from and prevent a serious illness. She calls it body maintenance. It includes walking, exercise, and activities at the center, like chair volleyball.
All set? All set.
You realize at the end of about 40 minutes, you're glad that game is ending. It is considerable exercise. But above all, it is my laughing time. Twice a week, almost every stroke of the ball brings a laugh. We have a lot of repartee that goes on during the game, and that is my laughter prescription for the week.
The Senior Center's Executive Director, Karen Wolford, understands the importance of these services in local seniors' lives.
We've got to make sure that every senior that we know and every member that we have has a purpose to get up in the morning, because that's going to give them that longevity. And if we can give that through the activities that we provide to seniors, through giving them home assistance, providing them transportation when they cannot drive, then we've done what we need to do to continue to give them purpose.
It's reciprocal. The center relies on its member volunteers to provide these services almost every day of the week.
All of our groups are led by volunteers, and so whatever we can do to get a volunteer involved and to get them to be in charge of a group, because it gives our seniors the purpose that they're looking for. We wouldn't be able to function without the volunteers.
Although these opportunities to volunteer exist within the community, 84-year-old Helen Ayers says local seniors are assets and have what it takes to do even more.
We find our way into many kinds of activities, but I'm not sure that the younger population, that the working population, appreciates what all could be done. One of the things that really concerns me is being assigned to chores instead of recognizing that we bring a lot of different kinds of experience, that we bring knowledge and ability to do more than simply help out now and then. We can also initiate and do much of the organization and take responsibility for many kinds of activities. Some of us who've made it this far have some responsibility to see if we can help folks realize there's a whole lot beyond, and it's different, and it's different.
I'm Ashley Appleman with WYSO's Community Voices.
The Village Harmony Choir is a Vermont-based organization that creates choir workshops and traveling summer camps for teens and adults alike. The Village Harmony Choir Midwest Teen Summer Camp came to the WYSO studios in the midst of their travels to sing some beautiful songs as well as to speak about their organization. The Midwest Choir consists of camp leaders Molly Stone, Emily Miller, and Gideon Crevichet, as well as the 13 to 17-year-old choir members who just met each other 7 days before their appearance on WYSO. Here's just one tune from that special performance.
Gideon and I are part of a singing group called the Starry Mountain Singers, and we were asked to be part of this 2-CD set. And so we, the producers, sent us a track of Jean singing this beautiful traditional song that I had never heard before in her gorgeous high voice, and our singing group arranged it for 7 voices. So we have adapted that arrangement for the choir, so you'll hear this beautiful Jean Ritchie traditional tune called I've Got a Mother.
I've got a mother gone to glory. I've got a mother gone to glory. Look away over yonder on the golden shore, away up in heaven, away up in heaven. I've got a mother gone to glory. Look away over yonder on the golden shore. Some bright day I'll go and see her. Some bright day I'll go and see her. Look away over yonder on the golden shore. Away up in heaven. Away. Day I'll go and see her. Look away over yonder on the golden shore.
I've got a father gone to glory. I've got a father gone to glory. Look away over yonder. shore. Some bright day I'll go and see him. Some bright day I'll go and see him. Look away over yonder on the golden shore. Away.
Village Harmony Choir performing live on Excursions this past week. You can hear more from them at WISO.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of late summer. Middle August brings the sun almost halfway between summer solstice and autumn equinox. It is a time that lies halfway between the chorus of birdsong that characterizes the first part of the year and the chanting of insects that marks transition to the second part. Continuing their middle summer pattern, cicadas chant from an hour or two past sunrise to dusk, and then whistling crickets begin their long trills and the sing-song crickets start their rhythmic cadence. Katydids join in at dark, and they love the middle of the night, but they all abruptly cease their calls as dawn approaches, and they grow quiet just before the cardinals sing the last of their summer morning songs. Sometimes doves, crows, a flicker, a blue jay, a chickadee, or a wren will call too. Then almost all the birds grow silent after about an hour, ceding conversation to cicadas once again. If the day is hot, yellow jackets come to eat the fallen apples and peaches. Fall webworms crawl from their silver webs. Bees and wasps are everywhere in the fields, and sometimes five or six land on a single flower cluster. Butterflies continue their passage through the gardens. Halfway to equinox, first brown Asian lady beetles arrive, looking for places to spend the winter. Giant but harmless caterpillars of the Cisteronia regalis moth, the hickory horned devils as they're called, partial to black walnut trees, wander through the first of the fallen leaves. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of late summer. In the meantime, pay attention to the birds and the insects. They tell the time of year.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wiso.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next week. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
Mark your calendars, Sunday, September 7th. It's the WISO Community Concert presented by Logos at Work. Plan to join us at Riverscape Metro Park in downtown Dayton for an evening of funk, soul, and reggae. It's a free concert featuring Joss Soul, William the Accountant, and Johnny Dredd and the Mystics. There'll be food available for purchase as well as adult beverages. Additional support comes from Wagner Subaru and Five Rivers Metro Parks. Bring your friends and family, bring a chair, and see you there.
Hold this up, big idea, outside my window.